Welcome, everybody, to Sharpen That Axe, a podcast dedicated to strengthening your skills as a guitar player.
My name is Dylan Murphy. Strengthening my skills? Is that it?
Did I say that? Strengthening my skills.
No, you said strengthening your skills. I presume you're talking to me.
Oh, right. This is like that bear from The Simpsons. By you, you mean me. My name is Dylan Murphy, a songer, singer-writer, guitar player, guitar enthusiast, and joined this week with me, like every week, is John Gillan. John, how are you?
I'm doing well. I am John Gillan, and I play guitar, talk about guitar, write about guitar, all things guitar, and do some streaming with guitar as well. So,
absolutely. You were doing that yesterday.
I was doing that yesterday, so off of twitch.tv, and then you can do /silversoundguitar. Where you can, I don't know, come and troll, because that's honestly what most people do. So I see you're drinking out of your Guinness mug there. I have my obligatory Carol's Irish souvenir shop mug here with the big gaudy Celtic cross on the front.
Well, aren't we a bunch of tourists?
Yeah, it's, well, and it's very Irish weather today too, so...
John's the guitar podcast. No, I am the prize. Guitars. For this episode, as you can probably tell from our title, we will be joined by the lovely Neely Brush. John, can you fill us in on Neely Brush for people that do not know?
Yeah, so Neely Brush is a ridiculous guitar player, which is why she's on the show. But she's played in several different capacities. She recently did some stuff with, oh gosh, what is it called? Cirque du Soleil. Yes. And in the Michael Jackson things, she of course laid down all the fancy solos and the parts. Obviously, everyone knows the solos for songs like "Beat It," where you had Eddie Van Halen playing that. Of course, she puts her own stamp on those solos as well. She's got solo material. She has toured with
Tony McAlpine.
Thank you. And yeah. Basically, fantastic guitar player. She was an absolute gem, great person to have on the show, and a great fun to talk to as well. So, absolutely. As you will see,
I'm kind of put off a little bit by how nice everyone we have on the podcast is. Everyone is just super friendly, and it's not, I don't know, it's off-putting because they're beasts on the axe, but they're also beasts with great personality, which is...
I know. Couldn't you, like, have some flaws so I can feel better about myself?
Gosh darn it. So, as always, we have the lick of the week. So, John, it is your turn to choose, and I have it loaded up here.
And chosen I have. Again, I feel like this week's kind of an easy one, but we haven't talked about this guitarist, I think, at all yet. So,
I'm very intrigued. Okay.
Yeah, so I think it needs to happen.
So let me look it up. It's in my drive folder. We can edit this out. John, I'm going to be honest. I don't know this song, so I don't know this band, but I'm going to give me a guess. I'm going to go for it. Is it Rush?
It is, yes. Good.
Do you know what term? Let me know. It was the drumming as opposed to the guitar playing. Right.
The roto-toms that come in there at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like that joke, you know, how many drummers does it take to screw in a light bulb? 50, one to turn in the bulb, and 49 to say how Neil Peart could have done it better.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So, John, tell me a little bit about Alex. It's Alex Lifeson, isn't it?
Alex Lifeson, yes. So this is Spirit of Radio off of the Permanent Waves album. And I think what makes Alex Lifeson an interesting guitar player is, and Rush in general, is just kind of the way everything fits together. They're all excellent musicians, but they kind of bring their own elements to things as the whole thing comes together. And Neil Peart is the one who writes the lyrics, but it's Alex Lifeson and Geddy Lee who get together and write the music. And then they bring it back to Neil, and he kind of, like, that's where he starts putting the drum stuff in. but they usually have some sort of idea of what they want the drums to sound like too. So it's this weird kind of back and forth and meshing together that just works. It works for him. And Alex Lifeson, I think, is a little bit of an underrated player in the sense that Neil Peart's kind of the guy who gets the most attention from Rush for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But
well, Geddy Lee can also play the bass and keyboards at the same time
and not miss a note when he sings. It's ridiculous. I've seen him live twice and mind-blowing. Absolutely mind-blowing. None of them miss a note. I mean, it's amazing. They're right on top of it. And Alex Lifeson's solos, I think, are also interesting because particularly if you're a theory nerd and you're willing to break it down a little bit, but they're a little bit outside of what you would sort of normally expect.
From the kind of prog rock realm?
Well, I mean, I suppose in the prog rock realm, they seem maybe a little bit more normal. But
yeah, because they have hooks, you know, they're a real interesting band.
Yeah.
I have some friends that are big Rush fans, but, you know, over here, they're not really a big band.
Right. I suppose these friends of yours are Canadian?
No. I've one friend who he's the bass player with Stephen Sharp, and he is just a massive Rush fan, so much so that he has like he's building his own sort of Geddy Lee setup with the foot pedals for the keyboards and everything.
Oh, man.
He's a freak. Just the way his brain works, but he's kind of like got the scientist brain as well that I think those guys have, just the minute details. Also, there's a great Rush documentary that I have seen on YouTube called Beyond the Lighted Stage, which is where I learned all about them. You know, they were opening for Kiss like on their first tour.
Yeah. Which was that the tour before Neil Peart joined?
No, it was not. Neil Peart was on that tour. God, this is turning into a Rush cast. We got to get back to.
Come on, focus. Pedal talk.
Go on, focus. So pedal talk. What are we talking about for pedal talk? We're talking about Keeley pedals. A little bit about them. So, John, I will tell you what I know about Keeley pedals, and you can
correct me. And it's all wrong. I'm just going to tell you that now. It's all wrong. All of it.
All of it. Just like, you know, the government and your little, you know, your history, man. It's all wrong.
Aliens. Robert Keeley's an alien. That's how he does it, man.
That's it.
He's an ancient astronaut. Okay.
So Robert Keeley, that's where the name Keeley pedals come from. I am going to say that what I do know is if I look for a pedal, for example, a Boss Blues Driver, there will be the normal Boss version and then there will be the Keeley modded version, which is maybe about 30 to 60 euros dollars more.
Yes. So I recently looked up on Reverb, you can find a Keeley modded Blues Driver for 180 euro dollars.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's quite a, so what does exactly do the mods do?
Well, that particular mod is just a bass boost on that pedal, and he's got a true bypass switch that he put in that. Now, he has said on his own website that most of those that are out there, if they aren't actually his, there's kind of a glut of people just claiming that it's a Keeley mod. So they, you know, your man buys a Blues Driver, cuts it open, and does the modifications for it and calls it a Keeley mod. So consider that what is now, essentially, he took that circuitry and those ideas and he put it into what's now the Super Fat. And the Super Fat, brand new from his website, is 150. You're better off spending 150 instead of 180.
That's fat with a pH, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
Like in the late 90s.
Yeah, exactly. So
yeah. Cool. So who is Robert Keeley?
So Robert Keeley is kind of a fascinating story. He started out just by going to school for electrical engineering in Oklahoma. And then he started teaching some night courses. And it was there that he started realizing that, hey, instead of trying to get his hands on all these really high-priced fancy pedals from the early 80s and things like Klons and Ross compressors and stuff, his wife was like, hey, you went to school for this. You should be able to build them on your own. And he was like, that's a great idea. So he started doing that. And it started with basically copying the Ross compressor. And that's kind of where the Keeley compressor comes from. So, and then from there, he started modding blues drivers and TS9s and 808s and that sort of thing. And it just, this was about 2001. And at the time, the only other people doing anything were that were true bypass and sort of boutique style pedals were Full Tone and Analog Man. And that was it. And which is kind of crazy. I mean, that's only 15, 16 years ago.
That's crazy.
And you know, your other competition was Boss and the revamped Electro Harmonix and a handful of Ibanez pedals. So Keeley helped to kind of push this whole revival in boutique or handcrafted pedals. And now, I mean, there's so many, so many on the market. It just, it's exploded in the last 15 years, which is great for us. I think as consumers, there's so many things to choose from. And then an offshoot of his as well are these DIY pedals. One of the guys that was in his classes when he was still teaching is now the head of Mammoth Electronics, which you can order a Mammoth kit. And it's basically, if you have a soldering iron, you can take care of the whole thing. It's build your own pedal, you know, build your own clone or whatever. It's pretty easy to do.
And there's almost too much variety.
Exactly. So that's kind of, I mean, that's sort of his background, and you can still pick up a lot of these pedals. Like I said, the Super Fat Mod is that the blues driver, but it's just sort of in a different casing, and it's got a few other slight modifications on things. He's also a big fan of germanium. Now, do you know much about germanium transistors?
Hopefully I will not be the only one of us or our listeners that do not know what is germanium. Tell me about it.
Okay, so to be perfectly honest, and I knew very little about this until recently. So I had to do some reading up for a couple other reasons on pedal stuff. And I've got a friend here in town. He does all my guitar repairs, but he's kind of a pedal nerd as well. And he was showing me Bias. This is sort of sidetrack. Bias FX also has a pedal thing, and they've got all these, and it allows you to change out all the transistors, and you've got germanium and silicone and I don't know, a bunch of others that you can choose from. Anyway, the point being, Keeley uses a lot of these germanium transistors and talks about the difference between silicone and germanium. And silicone, the reason we use silicone transistors in all of our other electronics is because they're super clear. Germanium has a more rounded tone and tends to round out the highs, which is more what you want when you're using them in a distortion pedal or a fuzz pedal, unless you want that really sharp, kind of harsh cutting edge in metal zone in your pedals, right? So instead,
some people want that.
And depending upon what it is, I mean, it can work, obviously, because he has things like his Oxblood, you can have with the germanium or the silicone. The Red Dirt you can have with germanium or silicone. The Red Dirt's basically his 808 copy. But it gives a little bit more rounded tone. And if you think kind of like vintage overdriven tones from the 60s and early 70s, they were using germanium transistors. And as he puts it, the reason it's funny that we don't use the germanium in all of our other applications, but for the very reason we don't use it there, we want it in guitar pedals because it just kind of gives a nice warmer rounded sound as opposed to the super harsh silicone. So there you have I don't know, that's one of our nerdiest pedal talks right there.
Yeah, and that's saying something. I was just having a look before we started the episode at his compressor, his Keeley compressor. And it's only like 130 on his website right now. It looks really good.
Yeah,
talking about compressors last week.
So the original C4 compressor, I think, was one of his first releases in 2001. And then he's got the two-knob compressor as well. And then the new one, I think, is that the one, which one were you looking at?
Yeah, it just says Keeley compressor. I'll just double check my notes on my phone. Keeley compressor plus.
Yeah, that one's really cool because that one's got the switch with the single coil and the humbucker.
Yeah,
on it. So depending upon what you're playing, it's got some flexibility. It's $129. Like, that's for someone who has essentially made his name on compressors. I'd say that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I'm very, very. Yeah, I shouldn't be as tempted as I am. Good God, get me off the website. Get me off.
No.
So okay, that's awesome. Friends, check out Robert Keeley's deal. And you know, if you're gonna buy it, don't buy a ripoff. Make sure it's him.
Exactly.
He looks like you can tell he doesn't want to gouge anybody from the prices. He just wants.
Yeah, I would say definitely consider instead of looking for one of those modded blues drivers, just buy the Super Fat, for example, or the Red Dirt instead of the 808 or the TS9. And that's the other thing. He's got a couple of pedals that have combined different elements, which is really cool. So, yeah. Check it out. The DS9, that's what it is, where he's combined a TS9 and a Sonic Distortion as well. So,
ooh,
and you can switch very nice. Back and forth between the two. It's pretty amazing. Cool. Genius. Indubitably. Genius.
Awesome. We have a very special guest in our interview slot this week. Kind of different to something anybody we've really had before. I'd never heard of Neely Brush when you suggested her, and she made for a really good interview. I thought she wasn't going to tell us anything about the whole Cirque du Soleil experience, but she was fair game, and she was able to talk Maiden with us, which was always cool.
Yeah, exactly.
I had to nerd out a little bit there. So yeah, absolutely. Friends, enjoy our interview with Neely Brush.
Neely, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Super excited to have you here. Just for the listeners a little bit, can you just give us kind of a quick background and what you've been up to and what's next, I suppose?
Sure. Well, I was born in Israel. Grew up there till the age of 12 when my family moved to the Boston area. I started taking guitar lessons, eventually went to Berklee College of Music.
Cool.
And then released two solo albums and toured with Tony McAlpine and the Iron Maidens and did some solo stuff. And then now I'm playing with Cirque du Soleil. So that's in a nutshell.
Wow, that's
what a nutshell.
Crazy. that is definitely like condensing everything down. So
yeah.
I have so many questions already.
Go for it.
New Google Doc. That's so cool. So, what inspired you to play guitar? Like, what? Who were your first influences? Was it like, did you get turned on to Maiden eventually, or was that part of learning? Or why did you start?
Well, I mean, I loved music. It was always clear to me that I wanted to do something at least. The arts, if not in music, and my older brother Ethan Brosh, who's also he's a professional guitar player, a great guitar player.
Cool.
I wanted to be like him, you know, and I thought he was cool playing the electric guitar, and he introduced me to Nuno Bettencourt and Extreme, which is like my all-time favorite band.
Man, best.
So that kind of made me want to do the electric guitar thing, and I think you mentioned Maiden. That was kind of like a pretty appropriate segue from there. So that's kind of how it happened.
Cool. So what was kind of like that defining moment? Was it Extreme or Nuno? And just seeing that and being like, I gotta do that.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I, if it weren't for my siblings, like I wouldn't have heard, you know, cause I was born in 1988. So I wouldn't have heard that stuff growing up in the 90s.
Right.
But, yeah, of course.
You know, growing up with older brothers, we always had like Queen playing and Pink Floyd and stuff like that. And then when I heard like More Than Words and Wholehearted, I was like, those songs are so cool. And then I realized that the rest of that record sounded nothing like that.
Right.
But I thought it was so cool the way they had like, you know, hard rock songs and like funky rhythms and stuff. And I was just like very attracted to that. And I realized that the electric guitar is what's making those sounds. So right. It kind of went there.
Yeah, that solo from Get the Funk Out, that's just like, oh, one of my favorites of all time. It's
like Eruption on speed.
Have you seen the, there's a video on YouTube of Brian May listening to that solo and like,
yes.
It's so great.
I need to look that up.
Yeah, it's so good. So good. Yeah. Anyway, so that's really cool.
So just asking about Berkeley, the decision to move there. I mean, it's to go and learn. What would have been your biggest takeaway lesson from going to like legit big music school?
The reason that I went is because I love the fact that Berkeley has so many international students. I think it has like the highest percentage of, or it did at the time, highest percentage of internationals in any like bachelor's program. Cool. And I knew that in a school like that, I would be exposed to a bunch of different kinds of music, and I wouldn't have a choice, you know, because I didn't have the drive within me to independently like look up all these different kinds of music. So I was like, okay, let me just throw myself into an environment where it's just going to be around me and
very cool,
forced to learn all that stuff. So that's kind of why I went, and it was great. You know, you're kind of like immersed in all these different influences and people from all over the world and the teachers as well. And you're just, you know, I wanted to absorb as much as I could. And that was the best structure in which I could do that.
Do you feel like that really had an effect on your playing? I think probably the answer is yes, just because listening to your two solo records, I think that comes out a lot. But how would you describe that process in terms of being able to assimilate that material and then put it into your own writing?
Some of it was conscious and some of it was not, you know, just like everything else. I think the stuff that wasn't conscious was the stuff that came out better because I wasn't really trying to force it into any kind of mold or anything like that, you know. But some of it also happened like years later because you're not realizing how much you're absorbing at the time, and sometimes it takes years to kind of like process it, and then all of a sudden it comes out years later and something unexpected. Like I'm writing stuff now for my next album, and there's a lot of like different styles on it that I've never really experimented with, and some of it is just kind of like, where did this come from? I don't even know, but I've just listened to so much and have been exposed to so much different music over the years that, you know, you just kind of have to trust that at a certain point it's just going to come out of you.
Cool.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. And just asking about, so you've done so much gigging from like the Maiden stuff to Tony McAlpine to Cirque du Soleil stuff. After all this experience of playing music, have you got a practice routine that you stick by? Or, because we're big on like, how people practice and getting the most out of your practice routine.
Well, particularly when you have such a busy schedule. So I think there's a misperception of a working musician as like, well, they just practice all the time. And you also manage your own career. So there's so many, you have so many extra things to juggle. So how do you balance all that?
Yeah, there are. I mean, I'm lucky that I've had so much time to practice that now I can consolidate things a little better. If I had this, like, cause now, with the Cirque show that I'm doing, it's the Michael Jackson one show. We do 10 shows a week. So,
wow.
Which is already, that's already crazy. Right. But like, if it were just that, it would be like coming into work at 5:30, doing makeup, getting ready, doing the two shows and leaving at like 11. But that's not even all it is. Like sometimes we have rehearsals, or, you know, they treat me like one of the athletes, even though I'm a musician, but I'm running around on stage like everybody else. So they're scheduling me workouts and stuff like that. So some days I have to go in early and I just have like an hour or 2 hours in the morning to get whatever I can done. So, you know, now it's really just about like, okay, what's coming up? What do I have to do? You know, it's mostly like scheduling and prioritizing, like, do I need to do my video? Do I need to, like, is there like another side gig that I need to practice for? But again, like, a lot of it is really just the time management aspect more than the actual practice, and the fact that I've put in so many practice hours of my life that now I can thankfully do it in a fraction of the time. If I had this gig 5 years ago, I mean, I would have been a lot more stressed out. You know what I mean?
Of course,
it's all just experience. So, like, luckily I can just do it in less time now. But it wasn't always like that.
No, I think that's an important part: time management. And just, I mean, I think it probably goes for at any level. I know when I was at music school as well. Like, it was probably about to my junior year until I understood, like, this is how you can begin to break up your practice, and mm-hmm. you can get the most out of 2 hours instead of that. So what are some of the things that you do to kind of utilize that time management idea? Do you like write goals out before you sit down and do that stuff? Or is it just, you sit down and like, all right, this is what I'm doing.
Now I have to, you know, but you know, it's kind of like trying my best to balance like all the different aspects of the practice. You know, it's like, I'm going to spend an hour like coming up with new music, you know, or a new solo or something. And I'm going to spend an hour like on my improvising or something like that. And it's just become like, I know a little bit more or less now how long something's going to take, so I can kind of plan ahead. But a lot of the, what you're talking about, like maximizing your practice time, that takes years to kind of figure out. And especially with technique stuff, people don't realize it doesn't take as long as you might think. It just requires like the right kind of practice. So if I'm working on that, I might spend like 15 minutes practicing with a metronome really slowly and not even like increasing the speed or anything. But I'll just leave it at that and know that was productive practice. If I did 15 minutes too fast and messed up every single run, then, you know, then I'd be sitting there for 2 hours and not accomplishing anything.
Yeah, but of course.
It's just learning how to do that for, you know, through all these years. And, you know, I do always tell my students, like, even if you have 15 minutes, like, if you figure out how to maximize that, it's more practice than you think. It's just about figuring out how to practice so that you're like, it's hard to explain, but like how to practice something so that you have a high success rate and not like messing it up every single time. And that's how you know that the practice is productive.
That's really good advice. Do you find probably one of the biggest hurdles with students is to get them just to play it slow and accurately?
Yes.
Okay.
And you're getting so much more out of that, because even I'm a believer that like most guitar players who've been playing for a while have the ability to play fast, you know, like physically move their fingers fast. Mm-hmm. And the trick is always, you know, the biggest complaints are either not being able to get your hands to sync up or just not being clean for whatever reason. Yeah. So I'm always a believer in, well, you can move your hands fast. You have the fast thing down, but to be able to do it cleanly, you just have to teach your muscle memory to do it correctly every single time. So you have to find the tempo at which you're doing it correctly every single time. And whether that tempo is really slow doesn't really matter, because that's the tempo at which you're teaching your hands the repetition of the correct movements and the habit of doing right every single time. And then you may not even need to increase that speed gradually. You might just be able to jump on to the fast tempo and just be able to do it, because you already have the ability to play fast, but you already like polished all the problems in the slow tempo, and now your fingers have memorized how to do that correctly. So accomplished in like not that much time. You just have to do it slowly and like fight that urge to speed up. So that's why, you know, like I don't spend that much time on it, because I do it slowly and well, and I just trust that it's going to work. And plus it's like a lot better for your confidence, because if you're spending 15 minutes nailing it every single time, you're going to feel a lot better about where you are than playing it too fast and messing it up every single time. Like how many of us have walked away frustrated wanting to throw the guitar out the window because it worked, you know?
How many times today have I felt like that?
Yeah, I don't want to do that anymore. So, but it is, you know, I think it's just the guitar player problem, like not being able to slow down. Like I'm just as guilty as anybody else. Like you ask somebody to play something slowly and they play it fast. It's just who we are, you know? We just, it's like a lifelong struggle. Like you're just going to be fighting, playing it slow no matter what happens. It's just being a guitar player.
Yeah.
Struggle is real.
For sure. So you also mentioned improvising in your practice. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things that you do to work on your improvisatory skills? Like what does that look like for you? Do you use backing tracks, or do you make your own backing tracks as a kind of a composition improvisation kind of thing, a writing exercise maybe?
Yeah, I mean kind of all of the above. For me, I've always felt that writing solos has come a lot more naturally to me than improvising. Mm-hmm. But then what I realized is that the way that I write solos is kind of like improvising in slow motion. Like, and what I mean by that is that the way that I write the solos is like I'll listen to whatever the track is. I'll hear the first idea in my head, pause, you know, kind of figure that out, and then get the next idea, you know, and repeat and so forth and so forth. And that's what great improvisers do. They just do it in real time. You know what I mean? Like they get the idea and they just play it right away and you go from there. So I've kind of tried to adopt that idea into my improvising and just kind of do that with the track in real time, but giving myself those pauses, you know what I mean? So that if I get the idea and I nail it down, then I pause if I need time to think or whatever. And that just kind of polishes that particular skill over time. And it also really develops your sense of phrasing, because I think the biggest problem with improvising, at least for me, and for, I think for a lot of other guitar players, is that it's hard to keep the sense of phrasing in real time because there's so many other things to keep track of. Like, you know, you have to play the right notes and you have to be in time and you want to be executing well. So I think usually the phrasing is the first thing to go. And also we don't need to keep track of it because we don't have to breathe. We don't have to stop. We can keep going forever if we want to. So that method of kind of like coming up with the idea, really hearing it in your head, like getting the pure idea first, and then like pausing to hash it out, it gives you that sense of phrasing because you're like, okay, this is a complete thought that starts here and ends here. And now I have this pause and I know where to take it from. So naturally you kind of like develop a natural sense of phrasing there and you don't get onto that playing run on sentences all the time because you're doing it in real time and you're not realizing that you haven't stopped, you know?
Yeah, no, so that's helped me a lot. That's perfect. I love the idea of phrasing as a sentence. It's something I talk about a lot.
Yeah, it's great.
But the the run on sentence analogy, it's perfect.
I mean, that's exactly what it is. I mean, and I feel like I'm kind of talking without punctuation right now because we're pressed for time, so I'm like trying to get the info in there quickly. But like, if you hear somebody like just talk and there's no punctuation, the ideas might be there, but they're really hard to, like, you kind of have to go back and edit what the person said just to get the ideas out. So it's kind of the same thing with improv. Like the ideas might be there, but if you don't have punctuation in your sentences, it's going to be really hard for the listener to grab that.
That's great advice too.
That's great. Really, really good.
Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you can go over. We've got our list of questions
here. Oh, yeah. Dylan?
Yeah, I was wondering. So as a player, John and I have been doing our masters and we found like didn't really have time to practice and some of that. And we kind of got stuck in a rut guitar playing wise. Mm-hmm. From hearing what your thoughts on improv and stuff, it doesn't really sound like that really happens to you. But do you find yourself ever getting into a rut guitar playing wise? Or are you just so busy that you can't afford to?
Or you feel like your phrasing tends to be very similar maybe and you're looking for something a little different?
Yeah, I mean, I totally get in ruts, you know, like especially now, like, I mean, I'm working on new things just to keep stuff going, but I don't feel like just because I'm creating new stuff in like a time crunch, that means that it's really looking for a new thing. You know what I mean? Sometimes it's just like, it's just your vocabulary and you're doing another solo or whatever. But of course I don't feel like now I have the time to really go and seek out like really new ideas and really get re-inspired and everything because I don't have that much time and everything is kind of repetitive. So of course I have rest just like everybody else. I think the hardest thing is to really explore new things all the time. And that is something that you need time for.
So if you are pressed for time, how do you personally try to find a way to break out of that?
Listen to different kinds of music that doesn't have guitar in it or that I'm not really familiar with. That's a really good way to go because it's completely different than what you're doing no matter what, you know, like there might be similarities, but it's not what you're already doing. And again, it's that same concept of like not trying to force it consciously and just letting that absorb and just hoping that it comes out sometime in the near future as you're working on something new.
That's great advice, because you can do that anywhere as well.
Yeah. And I think as far as that is concerned, for me, I would rather like just do that as a listener and not try to push the practice, not call it practice, because I think if you put that pressure on it,
it takes the fun out of it.
It takes the fun out of it, and it might not come out as naturally. If you're just treating it as like, oh, I'm listening to something new that I'm inspired by, that's really cool, and I'm just enjoying it as music, you know, then it might come out of you easier just because you're having fun with it. You know, you're not treating it as an assignment. It's just kind of like you're remembering why you love music in the first place. So that's, I think that's always the best way to go.
Absolutely. No, that's great. Sorry, just as a question kind of follow on from that, is there anything that you've been working on kind of right now? We have a segment on our show called What We've Been Working On, and every week we kind of bounce off one another saying kind of personal goals or projects. How about yourself? Is it all been based around the Cirque stuff, or have you been doing other kind of stuff that you've been devoting time to playing wise?
Yeah, well, there's a few things. So the Cirque thing, you know, happens twice a night, and there's no improv. Like, it's exactly the same show all the time. So yeah, that's nice in one sense, because you really get to polish it. You really hear new ones, and I have in-ears, so that really helps. Like,
nice.
I definitely don't need help to be hard on myself, because you're like, you hear the tiniest differences from show to show. So that takes care of that part. I have a gig coming up next month with Alfonso Johnson, who is a bass player for Weather Report. And cool. It's a fusion gig. So we're doing like standards and all different kinds of stuff like that. So that's a totally different ball game. And then I have my weekly licks that I'm trying to, like, it's the third year I'm doing it. So it's constantly coming up with new stuff and, like, you know, sometimes kind of banging my head against the wall because I'm out of ideas. and then I'm working on my new album, which is like, I guess my primary goal is, because it's going to have so many different styles on it, it's almost like a sort of approaching fusion of styles from another direction, because it's not necessarily the classic like fusion of rock and jazz, but just trying to figure out, okay, I have all these different styles. How do I make them mesh on one record? How do I make it work for my style of guitar playing? Is this even possible? Is it going to work, or is it not going to make sense? So that's probably the biggest challenge I'm working on it at the moment.
Cool. And when should we expect that album?
That's a very good question. Well, here's the timeline in my head right now. It's like, this gig with Alfonso is like taking up a lot of time, because, you know, I really want to do it justice. Right. Some of the standards are very difficult, a lot of changes and everything. So I'm devoting as much time to that as I can right now. That's next month. That's like on October 20th. Cool. I'm also in the process of like relocating to Las Vegas right now for Cirque. I mean, I'm already living here and working, but like I haven't like moved yet. So I'm doing all that stuff. Once that's done, I'm
real
going
life.
Back to
oh,
like
God.
Devoting the time to the record. What's that?
I was like, real life. Oh God.
Not yes. Yes. Oh, stuff. There's yeah. There's relocating way too much adulting going on right now.
It's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. I just have a small question that I really want to ask. I think I was in San Diego when I didn't know you were in the Iron Maidens. That's so cool. I was in San Diego a few years ago when you guys were playing, and I think I was underage. I couldn't get into the bar. But any personal favorite like Maiden guitar songs that you personally enjoyed or anything? I love all that stuff.
I love it too. Do you mean like as far as playing or listening?
As playing goes, like stuff that you enjoyed playing.
There was one gig that I got to do the Adrian Smith parts, because obviously that's Courtney Hoffman's thing. But yeah, there was one gig where I was covering for her, and so I think some of the, you know, the Somewhere in Time stuff, like the Wasted Years solo and like all that classic stuff with a ton of chorus on it. I love his phrasing. I love how like organized it is, you know?
Yeah, you can hum it. Like, it's great.
So, yeah, and like the Trooper solo, like all the classic like Adrian stuff was really, really fun to play. Anything from like Somewhere in Time or Power Slave or Seventh Son is like my favorite shit.
British. Yeah. I had to ask that, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's awesome. Believe me, I can talk about that all day.
But we would love to have you keep talking if we could, but we know
I got a couple more minutes.
Okay, cool.
Good. We'll just keep asking questions.
Okay.
We have a kind of a go-to question for our, we've had guitar players on and non-guitar players on, but one thing we like to ask is, what's your desert island pedal? Or do you have one or effect? You're on a desert island with a guitar and an amp and one pedal. What would it be?
It's the Exotic Effects EP Booster.
Personal favorite of us both.
Yeah.
I think it is for a lot of people for good reason.
Yeah, it's do you have it always on or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably the best question. It's always on.
It's definitely my always on pedal. It's the Make Your Tone Better pedal.
Yeah. I'm going to repaint that on it. Just
They should market it like that. I think it would work well for them.
I've known people that have two of them on their board so that they have one that's always on and then one actually functions as a boost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Ah, that's
it's
great.
A game changer.
Mm-hmm.
Class. And I suppose I've kind of run out of our list of questions.
Okay.
Do you have any like personal favorite apart from Nuno? Do you have any other like guitar gods that you kind of would constantly go back to, mm-hmm. like players for inspiration?
Yeah, Simmons, Greg Howe, Guthrie Govan, Steve Lukather.
Lukather, yes.
Yeah. Jimmy Herring.
John is a Toto nerd. John is a complete Toto nerd. So we'll forgive that.
I love all that stuff. You know, in the have you ever been to the Guitar Center in Hollywood?
Yeah, yeah.
You know how they have those handprints? So I remember like going there and every single player's handprints were like way bigger than my hands, obviously.
These are tiny.
But Steve Lukather's were like the only hands that were my size, and I was like, "Yes, I will take it."
That's awesome. Yeah, I still have a Luke, and part of the thing that surprised me about it was just the neck dimension on
it. It's tiny.
It is.
Perfect.
And yes. I remember meeting him when I was in high school, and it was just like, "Holy cow!" He's sort of a normal sized human being. You know, Steve Vai's
with terrible shirts.
I know. I always feel like I wonder if there's a connection between his sized hands and the mold method. Because to me, he's like a really great combo of like great chops that are always used tastefully and like super musical all the time. And like, I kind of wonder if that had to do with it, you know, because like, I feel like if I had bigger hands and I could stretch wider or whatever, like maybe I would abuse that, you know? So I kind of wonder if that had something to do with it.
Yeah. I don't know. That would be interesting. I know for myself, like there's a tendency to kind of try to push that thing to sort of get into that Alan Holdsworth type. How many fingers mm-hmm. can I fit on the fretboard and how far apart can they go?
Yeah, it's very difficult for me. There's just certain things that I you know, like Guthrie does that a lot, you know, he does a lot of stretching and like big intervals and stuff. And there's a lot of that stuff that it's just like, if you try to finger it a different way, it just doesn't really work. So there's a lot of stuff that I'm not going to be able to do because I can't stretch that far. But it's just, I mean, you know, it's just a different approach on the instrument. So it's not like, it's not a make it or break it thing. It just makes me wonder about people's hand sizes, because you obviously don't need big hands to play guitar, but right. I just wonder if it has something to do with the way that you play. And I think like, you know, trying to prove that, like, how do you research that? You know, like that's a different thing. That's a hard thing to quantify. So.
Well, I think when you ultimately talk about phrasing, like that's just kind of the big thing. So it just needs to come back to that, regardless of whether or not you have Steve Vai hands. So
yes. Dude, that guy's hands are massive.
Yes.
I don't know anybody that has bigger hands than Steve Vai.
I don't know if it's so much his hands, but I think his fingers are just longer than everything else.
Yeah.
Like, yep. It's crazy.
Spider hands.
Crazy. It looks like there's a spider on his guitar. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway. Well, we've hit the Steve Vai part of the episode, which every episode seems to hit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tory segment, right?
Yeah,
it is pretty much for John. It is anyway.
Yeah, I think we need to get that siren on there that he had on the Fire Garden tour. Like he always had that siren that sat on the top of his amps, and I feel like we just need to have that go off every time we mention Steve Vai. Like that's it's time to end the episode at that.
Cool. Neely, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Guys, this was awesome. Thank you so much.
All right.
Yeah, we'll be in touch about when it's released and everything. But best of luck with everything. Can't wait to hear the album.
Thank you. Thank you.
And where's the gig?
It's in Chicago. It's part of the Progtoberfest festival. Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. Cool.
All right. Yeah, so I found it really interesting. I really enjoyed one of the things that I took away from that really was just the idea of, and I talk about this a lot with students, making sure that you have a solid phrasing idea as you're kind of, even if you really want to shred, make sure that there's something that comes out of that, that you take a breath, for example, because music is still like a language and you need to breathe occasionally when you're speaking. So,
yeah, absolutely. I love that as well. I mean, you can see that she has the chops, but I mean, if you like I've said before, like, if you can't hum it, then what's the point?
Right.
wanking for the sake of wanking's sake. I love it. She's I loved her advice. I loved her just I don't know her approach to the guitar. It was really really cool.
Indubitably. So I think that brings us on to the next bit here. And
our next bit, our famous next bit.
Famous next bit is what have you been working on?
Oi, John, oi, you put me in a corner here.
Ooh, I know, you're in the middle of moving house and preparing to go on your long vacation. Well, you'll leave the rest of us in this world out in the cold while you're
gonna go
sipping
eat,
mojitos. I don't know what you sip on the sandy beaches of Vietnam. I'm just gonna say
something along those lines. I don't know. I don't even know if there. I haven't done any research. I just know that I'm going in like 9 days. Beaches.
Japanese lager. I have no idea.
That's it. Yeah, I don't know. I have not been working on stuff per se, but I have been. First of all, I've got a gig tonight and a gig tomorrow. One in my hometown of Limerick and another in my adopted hometown of Galway. So I will be hopefully sneaking in some practice before they happen. But apart from that, I've actually, the one thing I have been working on is getting an old guitar fixed. I have a lovely Korean-made Epiphone Les Paul that's just
okay,
been
so
gathering
tell us,
dust.
Tell us the background story on that guitar.
it was left to me by a friend who did not want it anymore. It's a long story. If you're listening, I don't want to go into that. My mother's boyfriend left a guitar behind, so it's not mine. But you know, I'm getting it fixed up, so whatever. It's a yes, it's a gorgeous Korean Les Paul with little Gibson symbol on the headstock, which plays just like a dream. It weighs a ton, but it's really really nice, and I just got it set up for 30 yo-yos, so I am really looking forward to sinking my teeth into that. Also, I am doing some more recording next week, so I will definitely be bringing that along, making them humbuckers sing. But what about you, John? What have you been working on?
Oh man. So I have mentioned this before, but I've got a student who's working on a Steve Vai tune, so I'm neck deep working on this Die to Live piece. So
Die to Live.
Die to Live. It's about how it feels at the moment. And I've got a couple other students. I've been transcribing some stuff for students, and then Little Wing, the Stevie Ray Vaughan version. So I've had my work cut out for me with a few students here, but it's been good. Pushes me a little bit. And with both of those tunes in particular, the Stevie Ray Vaughan tune and the Steve Vai tune. I think one, it helps to be named Steve when you're playing guitar. So
I think so. You're basically setting yourself up there. If Steve Vai ever released like a set of weight loss CDs or something, he could call it Diet to Live. Sorry.
We need a soundboard because that was I just need the honk, trumpet. Honk.
My little horn. Have you been listening to anything thus, John, or have you just been listening to your beloved Steve Vai?
No, beloved Steve Vai. Yes, I would say so. But it hasn't been a whole lot of guitar-heavy stuff. So kind of, for example, like Lisa Hannigan type stuff, Lila Foy type stuff. In particular, Lila Foy, off of her one, there's a couple of songs that I like the way she does, or her guitar player is probably a better way to put it. I love the guitar tone. It's this big, echoey, spacey, simple, but great tone. And it's, I don't know, it's good songwriting and it's good ambiance and it's perfect for the weather. So there you have it.
Cool. I do not know Lila Foy at all, but I do love Lisa Hannigan, like every Irish red-blooded male.
Similar vein. It would be worth a listen.
Very curious. Sweet. I have discovered a band called Greta Van Fleet, which is not a woman, like I thought it was. And then I looked at their EP cover. Their EP is called Black Smoke Rising. And I thought, oh, it's a bunch of women, but it's not. It's a bunch of long-haired males. Very pretty, pretty men, as you would say. And it is the closest thing to a Led Zeppelin cover band you can best be.
Oh, just, really?
Yeah, they're cool, man. They're a bunch of young lads. It's all slide guitar, like it's all open tuning stuff. Really, really nice. But like the drumming isn't Zepp, but the singing is just Robert Plant down to a T. It's great. I really like it. And the EP is the only thing I've heard, but their live videos, they can wail, Breath would say.
As they say.
And apart from that, because I wanted to get away from guitar stuff for a while, because we all got to take a little bit of a break. Langham, I don't know if you know them. They're an Irish kind of a new folk band. They released their an album last week, which I really, really liked. So yeah, I check out that. It's really, you know, they sing with a very, very thick Irish accent, very thick Dublin accent, but I really, really like it. Really good folk music, folking good music.
What was the name again?
The band is called Lankum, Lankum, and the album is called, I have it here, Between the Earth and Sky. And I also went to see Father John Misty again 2 days ago. And
did you throw your thesis at him?
I did not. I did not get a chance to print it out and throw it at him, because printing it out would have been very expensive, because that's a lot of paper.
Yeah, it's like 30 euros or whatever, isn't it?
Yeah, to get it bound. Yeah, I'm not gonna waste. He also probably would have just thrown it back into my face. And so yeah,
hit you in the head.
Yeah, why did you waste so much time on this? So yeah, that's me. Friends, we have some amazing more guests and episodes coming up in the next few weeks. We have Christoph Godin. We have a few other people as well. Very, very excited about sharing them with you.
Yes.
Thank you very much to all our new listeners and likers and everything. We got some got a few this week, thanks to the Buckethead episode.
Sorry, not Buckethead. Wrong person. Wrong Guns N' Roses guitar player.
It began with a B and had a body part in it. That's what I thought. that's it. John, I will see you next week.
Oh, will you?
I will, before I leave forever. Yes. Friends, stay sharp. We'll talk to you soon.